Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. My name is Mildred J. Menlo. With my partner, Mari Lurie, we are interviewing Dr. Bernard Kleonski on February 6, 1989. Dr. Kleonski, where do you live?
5867 Wilkins Avenue, Squirrel Hill.
And who is part of your household now?
At the moment, my wife and I are alone.
Your wife's name?
My wife is Esther. Esther Walder Kleonski. W-A-L-D-E-R.
And how long have you been married?
We've been married now, we'll be married 39 years.
Well, tell us something about your family, your parents, brothers, sisters.
Okay. My parents were both born in this country of immigrant parents relatively shortly after their parents had come to this country. My father, Max, was born in New York City and moved to Binghamton, New York, when he was an infant. My mother was born in Binghamton, New York, and they knew each other from childhood and eventually married and established their family.
Where
in
did
Binghamton,
your
New York.
Parents come from, your grandparents?
My maternal grandparents came from a little settlement they call Baltimance, which is sometimes seen in the books as Butrimance, near Vilna. And my father's family came from near Minsk, and they say Minsk Gubernia. I think that simply means a province near Minsk.
What was your mother's name?
My mother's name was Marian Rosevsky, R-O-S-E-F-S-K-Y. It's of some curiosity that my wife's mother's family came from the same shtetl, and that the two grandmothers knew and remembered each other from childhood days in Baltimance. So that sort of put the stamp of approval on the wedding. Mm-hmm. I really don't know where my wife's father's family came from.
How do you spell Baltimore? I know Vilna.
I mean, B-A-L-T-E-M-O-N-T-Z, or I've seen it B-U-T-R-E, Butrimance, Baltimance.
You have a family?
I have four children. My eldest daughter is a pediatric radiologist living in Rochester. My next child is a son who's a physician with an MBA, currently living in Chicago, and giving consulting advice to business and government on how to better structure their medical care programs. My third daughter is living in Richmond, Virginia. She has two children. And my fourth son is living in Chicago as a commodities broker.
How old are your children?
Well, my daughter Nina will be 37 and 36, 35. Danny's about 30.
Is she married, your daughter Nina?
Nina's married to Leon Metley, also a Pittsburgh family, the son of the late Max Metley. Katie, who is still alive, living here in Pittsburgh. Leon is a pediatric pathologist at the University of Rochester. My son Matthew is married to a Susan Rosenberg from Chicago, and they're due to have their first child any day now. Ruth, the one from Richmond, is married to Stephen Shapiro, whose family is from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And he's a pediatric pediatric neurologist at the University of Richmond. And my son Danny is married to Janae Studnitzer from the Bronx. And he's actually the interesting in a Jewish sense, because he's the only one who spent 4 years living in Israel and 3 years as a paratrooper in the Israeli army before coming back to the States to go to college with every intention of returning to Israel, but had met an Orthodox young woman and married and had a family, and at the moment he looks like he's not heading back. But he's an Israeli, you know, dual citizenship.
That's interesting. Very interesting.
He was the only one of my four children who was not in university in 1974-75, when I did a sabbatical year in Israel and set up the Department of Pathology for the then brand new medical school in Beersheba. And the 10th grader, he came with us, and initially he hated it, but by the end of the year didn't want to leave, and persuaded us, we didn't take much persuasion, to allow him to spend a year in Israel after he graduated from high school, and at the end of that year decided that he would make Aliyah, promptly volunteered for the paratroopers, and spent 3 years as a paratrooper.
And then came back here.
Then came back to go to college. He was 18 at the time. So when he was 21, he came back to go to college.
And you went to a school at Harvard first.
I did my undergraduate work at Harvard. Did a year of graduate work at Syracuse University, and then medical school at Hahnemann Medical College, HAH, and the MANN Medical College in Philadelphia. Then did my, but was a traveling bum for a while, did my internship in Madison, Wisconsin, and my residency in pathology at the University of Kansas in Kansas City, Kansas. And then moved to Pittsburgh in 1961 when I had the offer of a faculty position in the university here as director of laboratories at the McGee Women's Hospital, where I remained for 27 years before leaving there and coming up to this position just a little over a year ago.
Dr. Kleansky, do you have particular specialties in your pathology?
I always had regarded myself as an OB obstetrical gynecologic pathologist, as a perinatal pathologist, which is really the pathologist in charge of the study of the newborn period, which is what I was perhaps most interested in, albeit I've really been most interested in that aspect of pathology that says I'm a trained problem solver. And am one of those pathologists who can claim that I have not done the same job any 2 years in a row for the last 35 years. And that pathology can provide, you know, I designed the laboratories at McGee, I set up the financial systems, I set up the microbiology laboratory. I was the first to create the concept of centralized laboratories for the University Health Center hospitals and created the central chemistry lab, then the hematology lab, then the immunology lab, one lab serving all of these operations, so that I've set up computer systems, the financial systems, the practice plan. So I'm now in charge of all the educational programs of the department. So I like to do something for 2-3 years, and when it gets to be routine, find somebody else.
And move on.
And move on. So that I've never really become as good in any one thing, and maybe as I might have been, because there always seems to be something that needs to be done that hasn't been done yet. And that to me has been one of the attractive aspects of pathology. It offers more degrees of freedom for what you do today, tomorrow, and 30 years from now. And I always felt it was sort of nice that at age 63, I could say I haven't had to decide what I want to be when I grow up.
Pittsburgh is your home.
After 28 years, yes.
Pittsburgh is your home. What sort of identification outside of medicine do you have with the community?
I've always been involved with the Jewish community, one through synagogue. We were among the founding members of Dor Chadash, and as we and our kids grew to a more traditional level of observance, joined Young People's Synagogue, of which I'm now the president, so very actively involved, you know, in that. Have always been involved in the Zionist Federation, of which I served, you know, as president and on their executive for a long period of many years. I've been very actively involved in the American Cancer Society, really for the entire time I've been in Pittsburgh, and have served as president of the Greater Pittsburgh Unit, president of the Pennsylvania Division. I'm now the scientific delegate from Pennsylvania to the National Board, and I'm being recycled. You know, I never quit my involvement with the local unit. Now I'm vice president of the unit, but I'm always, they always make me some officer at the unit level to make sure I stay on the executive committee. So last year I was treasurer, and this year I'm vice president again.
You know what I am curious about as far as the cancers, the American Cancer Society is concerned? Of late, you receive information from maybe 8 or 10 different research centers. Isn't there any central group that coordinates all this?
No, you are referring to what we call the look-alike problem. There are many organizations which are capitalizing on the good name of the American Cancer Society, the American Heart Association, by changing one or another of the words, and have really robbed the American public, who think they're giving to the American Cancer or Heart, and are literally siphoning millions of dollars away. Often one can't say, I have to be careful of libel, you can't say that they're not legal. But the legal requirements of various states are often very lax in what they require of organizations as a percentage of money spent on fundraising, or a percentage of money spent, you know, in administration, whereas the American Cancer Society spends something like 14% in administration and 10% in fundraising, you know, very nominal amounts as these things go, and well within accepted limits. Some of these others, you know, may give away 20, 30, 40%, but it feathers the pockets of the people who run them, and it's a national problem. And we're trying to mount, I just had a meeting of the Cancer Society the other day, trying to design the strategy of how the public can be informed of how they're being taken advantage of. We've had overtures to the state attorney general to be sure that Pennsylvania's laws, you know, are strengthened for, so that the requirements for what one has to do before you're an accredited charity in the state are more rigid than they are now. But it's a real problem.
I recognize that.
I mean, so many people come to me and say, but I just gave. But you didn't give to the American Cancer Society. We don't run a sweepstake. We don't run a lottery. We don't run a, you know, a nutrition quiz, or the number of gimmicks that they've done. And they're walking off with millions of dollars that should better be spent for a bona fide organization.
There are those who question it, of course, and understand, but it has become rampant.
I mean, I've got the figures. I've got nationally the literally tens of millions of dollars that are going, and some of them have exactly the same address for the American Heart and the American Cancer. I better be careful and name specific names, because I'm not, but there are a couple of them that are simply letter drops, where they're both the American Cancer and the American Heart and some private.
It is just too bad. You are involved, then, politically, in all of these cancer groups.
Yeah.
Are you involved in any way politically in the city?
No.
Nothing politically.
Well, even my involvement with the Cancer Society isn't primarily political. It's as a volunteer. And I guess you can't avoid politics when you deal with people, but it really isn't politics in the sense, you know, of getting people elected or maneuvering or whatever. It's in the sense of developing the programs and developing, you know, the ideas and trying to get things implemented. I was instrumental, among others, in the effort we made last year for the first time to have a breast cancer screening program, you know, in Pittsburgh. And that effort will be repeated this spring, you know, and that involves getting the various hospitals to agree to participate and to be sure the equipment is state of the art. In fact, we made a major contribution because a couple of hospitals wanted to participate, and we told them, you can't. Your equipment isn't good enough. And the radiologists in those hospitals were delighted because they'd been trying to get modern equipment. And the minute the Cancer Society said, we're going to have a public campaign and your hospital will not be included, they very quickly scurried and improved the caliber of their equipment so that they wouldn't be the only one whose name wasn't on the list.
Very important. Doctor, let's get back to school. You went to Harvard. What was the atmosphere in Harvard when you were there?
I started college in September 42. So that we're clearly, you know, in the war years in a very disorganized, a very atypical period for schooling in America, because some of the young men were being drafted after, you know, one term or two terms or three terms. We were going three semesters a year rather than the conventional two semesters a year. You'd go a semester and then a dormitory would be taken over by the Army or the Navy, and you'd move. So that it was a rather hectic and disconnected time, and rather less than the opportunities that college life ordinarily provides, perhaps a more serious period. And I went five consecutive semesters until my 18th birthday, and then went off to the service. So I completed roughly 3 years of college before I went to the Navy. And then after 2 years of service, came back, you know, for 1 year of what might be considered, you know, more conventional college career.
What did you do while you were in the Navy?
I was an electronic technician's mate. I had flunked the ASTP and V-12 physical by virtue of my eyesight. At that time, Captain Eddie of the Navy had recognized that the Navy had a modern electronic gun control, radar, sonar equipment, but nobody to repair it. And that the people who might be capable of repairing it, who had the educational background and the intelligence to repair this complicated equipment, were being co-opted as 90-day wonders, as ensigns on PT boats. And that they literally couldn't find anybody to fix it. So he said, we will admit to the Navy anyone who passes the test, even if their physical condition is such that they normally wouldn't have gotten into the Navy, which meant the people with the eyesight or flat feet or, you know, bad teeth or whatever. And with 3 years of, you know, college physics and calculus, I had no trouble passing an exam that a bright high school student who could operate a slide rule knew Ohm's Law would pass. So I went into the Navy and then spent 1 year in school and then 1 year shipped out with an assignment to the invasion fleet 5 days before the first bomb dropped. We circled 40 days in the middle of the Pacific waiting for the war to end and pulled into Okinawa after the peace treaty was signed. And sat out there for a year waiting for a ride home.
As you were growing up, you grew up in Binghamton. Where did you go to school there? Did you go to the public schools?
Public
there?
Schools. Mm-hmm. I don't think I ever heard of anybody who did anything but go to the public
schools. Go to the public schools, yes. And you... have any special interests in your adolescent years growing up there? in athletics or anything of that nature?
Well, I guess I remember the one thing that's of interest judaically is that there had never been a Hebrew school in Binghamton until I was 5 years old, whereupon my parents decided that the city needed a Hebrew school. And my father, among others, went door to door and knocking and collecting, you know, nickels and dimes and quarters, and they imported to Binghamton the most fantastic teacher I've ever met in my life, a guy named Isidore Israel Freeland, is it? who, may he rest in peace, just died about 2 months ago, and who made it such a pleasure to go to Hebrew school. We could hardly wait to go. We didn't only study Hebrew. He taught us classical music. We did mathematics. we read other things. The man was a Renaissance man of all things, and just made it such a pleasure to be with him. As an example of the kind of man that he was, when he finished the years of doing the routine Hebrew teaching, he became the director of the Jewish Community Center. And then when he retired, he became a professor at SUNY University, State University of New York, in Binghamton, as a teacher of Yiddish. And at the age of 80, they gave him tenure.
Wonderful.
You know, for many years in a row, for the 5 years he'd been there, having won the award as the best teacher in the university at age 80. Just an unusual... So I remember Hebrew school. Public school, high school, was always such a bore that I practically don't remember it. Always had time to work, you know, on odd jobs, and I worked in my uncle's law office, and... I had the problem, as one of my aunts put it, that kid will never amount to anything because he's never had to work. The schooling came just so easily that I could always, you know, get the top grades, and with never any apparent effort at working at it, was delighted that this high school was crowded. We only went about half a day because half a day was more than I needed.
Did you have any extracurricular activities in high school?
Not really. I mean, I collected stamps. We had what we called a fraternity, but we never dated. I left home when I was 16. You know, I'd always maybe been socially a little misadjusted because I had been skipped three times as we went along, and was always, by the time you come to an age of social activities, was always, you know, a year and a half, 2 years younger than the other kids. And was happy with school, Hebrew school, with my job.
You had a close family relationship.
Very, a huge family.
Your brothers and sisters?
My mother was one of five. My father was one of five. They were all in Binghamton. In the generation before, there were other members. So I must have had, I have 21 first cousins who were mostly in Binghamton, and maybe 100, you know, second and third and fourth.
What about brothers and sisters?
I have one brother, one sister. And, you know, so that the family and that kind of activity was, we were always, there was, our house was always the center of activity for kids playing. Relatives from Detroit, from New York, would send their kids, you know, to Binghamton. They thought it was the country for the summer. So we always had, you know, guests in the house. And I don't remember anything, you know, other special activities.
What is your
brother's
name?
We all skated, we all played tennis, we all rode bicycles, you know, there were lakes and swimming pools nearby.
Normal activities.
Yeah.
Your brother's name?
Cy Seymour.
Is he married?
He's married, four children, and unfortunately divorced and remarried, but...
Istrefza.
What?
I say Istrefza.
Yeah.
What about your sister?
And my sister, Eileen, is married to Robert Rabson, who for many years has been working for the Department of Energy as a research scientist. They live in Rockville, Maryland. And my brother has four children. My sister had four children. Unfortunately, may she rest in peace, one of her daughters was killed in a tragic accident a number of years ago, so there are three surviving there, and my brother has four.
What is your brother's profession?
My brother is a stockbroker, the president of the E.F. Hutton office, now a Shearson office in Binghamton.
But you still are close
as
a family. Interests that you may have, cultural interests of any particular sort?
Sort of a little bit of everything. You know, we go to the symphony, we go to the opera, I go to the chamber music, we go to theater when we can, I read a great deal. You know, with the volunteer activities, it somehow it seems that four out of five or, you know, nights of the workaday week, I'm on the road and going somewhere.
You have lived in a smaller city. I mean, after all, Binghamton is a small city, and it's practically at the foot of the mountains there, and now Pittsburgh. Do you contrast the life of both cities?
Yeah, I think in terms of a Jewish community, Binghamton was always very nice because you had the feeling that you knew the entire community. It was small enough that, and particularly with the web of interrelationships and relatives that I had, there was not an affair that we somehow weren't involved in, that some member of the family wasn't involved in. The kind of community where the Reform Rabbi could be given the award by the Orthodox community as the Man of the Year, with a much closer sense of interrelationships of all of the elements of the Jewish community. It doesn't have, at least when I was growing up there, didn't have many of the cultural advantages that a city of Pittsburgh has, although that's now changed substantially, because SUNY New York, which didn't exist when I left Binghamton, is now a major institution, you know, and really one of the crown jewels of the state university system of New York. So there's a fine university campus, and it's really had major impacts on the Jewish community as well, with a complete resurrection of the Orthodox Jewish community. The Department of Jewish Studies and a number of very distinguished Jewish scholars live in Binghamton and attend the Little Orthodox Shul, which is where we go when we visit the Binghamton. So that's been a remarkable,
very interesting
phenomenon for that community. Pittsburgh has sort of the ideal, from my point of view, of having one of the few large cities in this country which has maintained a relative integrity of its Jewish community, you know, and resources, and yet having all of the access of the broader community. But even after 28 years, you never end up with the feeling of the people who were brought up and raised and born, who have that web of interconnections that you never get even after 28 years. I mean, so I guess that's the essential contrast. Now, we, in many ways, Pittsburgh was not ideal for our children in that we had no living relative in the city and had to create your own kind of extended family to celebrate holidays, which we did, but each of my two sons, when the opportunity came, went out of their way to spend time, part of their training, in Binghamton, New York, just to have that feeling that they had when we would visit during the summer or on occasions, of living in the middle of a huge extended family. My son Matthew did his internship in Binghamton, not because it was the best internship in the world, but because it was in Binghamton. And Danny picked the State University of New York. It is a fine university, but he picked it because it was in Binghamton, and it gave him an opportunity of knowing his cousins and grandparents and uncles, and know, living in that kind of environment for a period of time.
In other words, in Pittsburgh, you have made family friends.
Yeah. But there you have family.
It's an interesting phenomenon, no question about it.
I mean, most of us have been very successful in creating really friends who are probably closer than most family really is, but who don't have the same emotional impact, you know, on kids who know that that's their family.
It's interesting to watch. Very often you find that they become as important to you as family members.
Oh, the pseudo-family that you meet really become closer, in many ways are dearer. But there is that distinction, and I think little kids probably ought to be somewhere near grandparents or people who will, you know, spoil them. But, you know, my four kids are all living elsewhere, whereas the generation before, the five Kleonskis and the five Rozevskis all stayed in Binghamton.
Did your wife have any particular training?
Yeah, my wife is a graduate of Radcliffe College, who, while she was going to Radcliffe, was attending the Boston Hebrew Teachers College.